So glad to see everyone here for this special weekend at Broadway. It's the weekend that I look forward to more than any other, I think, during the year, because my friend Joe Barnett gets to speak to us. You may have noticed that Larry Smith is not able to be with us today. He's in the hospital, and he was taken there. His diabetes has caused problems again, and he remains in the hospital, but he's at Jenny Seeley, and he wanted me to tell you how much he misses today. He was looking forward to being with us, but was unable to be so. I met several of you when you came in. We have some ladies from Saginaw, Texas, that we were able to have family names that we are associated with. We're glad to have you all with us. Met two men from the Emerald here in Galveston, and we're glad to have them. They know Sarah Campbell. Sarah is with us today. And our granddaughter, Caroline, that grew up in this church, is with us. She just had a birthday. I'm not going to tell you how old she is because it makes Mikey seem very old. Caroline has her very best friend that she had growing up here in Galveston, Corey. We're glad to have Corey with us. And Don and Helen Bryan, as you know, Don and I and Mariana were classmates at Abilene Christian. And so we go back many years, and they have come to hear Joe and to hear Mariana. I told you in my email a lot about Joe Barnett. No one has meant as much to the Churches of Christ in our generation than Joe Barnett. And he still works very hard every day to spread the gospel. I'm amazed every morning in 50 different nations of the world, people open up his writings on pathway evangelism. The devotional thoughts that start the day. I start my day by reading what Joe has written. I don't know if there's anybody here who does not receive this. It's free, and it's thoughts every day that will get your day started well. If you will give me, write down your name and your email, I'll see that you get put on the list, because we want everybody to see that. It's I just think how wonderful that is. We're very evangelistic at this church. And here is our speaker, who is read and studied in 50 different nations of the world. That makes it a remarkable ministry. And he started that at the time that he decided to retire as minister of the largest Church of Christ in the world. The Broadway Church in Lubbock, Texas, had about 3,000 people attending services each Sunday when Joe was the minister. And that is where Bill and Marie Nunley went to church when Bill was in graduate school. And so we go back a long ways and have friends. And today I want to mention one other family that's with us, Jim Middleton. Jim is the recently retired minister at the Northwest Church in Houston. He's preached for churches in Houston for over 52 years. He retired, and they've made him an elder now, so they still are using him. We're glad to have that Jim and Tony's son, Steve, to be active with this congregation, and we're glad to have Jim Middleton with us today. Sometimes people enter one's life at a critical point and they don't realize how important they are to that person. And I suppose that was true of Joe Barnett and my life. I was preaching in Carlsbad, New Mexico, and he at that time was preaching in Levelland, Texas, and we became friends And over the years, he has proven to be the most steadfast friend that I've ever had. And so I'm especially proud that he can be with us and proud for you to know Joe Barnett.
With Alan and I, it takes a little while to get this show on the road, but we're there, and I thank you very much for your kind comments. You know, very few people ever get to hear their obituary before they're gone, and so I appreciate these comments very much. It's so wonderful to be with you. It always is a very special Sunday for me when I get to be here, and for many years, you have allowed me to come on this particular Sunday, and I'm just deeply grateful for that. And I am so glad that Bill and Marie Nunley and Sarah Campbell showed up at the same place the same day. That's a very unusual situation. I'm always a little concerned about the Lord coming back and not being able to find them, because they travel all over the place. But it's good to see you, and thank you for letting me come. I want to begin this morning by acknowledging what prompted me to develop this particular sermon. I recently came across a little essay that mentioned Don Quixote, and it reminded me of a resolution that I made many years ago that I never did fulfill. I heard a sermon by the late Dr. Harold Hazlip in which he used the story of Don Quixote to illustrate something in his message. And I determined that day, because it was such an impressive message to me, that I was going to develop a message and perhaps use that story of Don Quixote. But time went on and I forgot about it until I recently picked up that little essay and saw the thing about Don Quixote. And so I just want to acknowledge and give credit to Harold Hazlip for the incentive of today's sermon. Let me begin it this way. In 1965, Dale Wasserman, who was an American playwright, went to Spain on vacation, and word got out that he was going to do something with that old story of Don Quixote, who had been written by Cervantes in Spain somewhere between the beginning and the middle of the 17th century. And so he did develop a play, and that play was called Man of La Mancha. And it was about Don Quixote. Don Quixote was a deluded, half-mad man whose delusion lay in the fact that when he would see a windmill, he would think it was a giant. And when he would see an old inn, he would think it was a castle. In other words, he was always seeing things as they could be instead of as they were. But that story at the time was nearly 400 years old, and no one in Spain had any particular expectation of a new staging of it, but it was staged. And the night of its opening, a very strange thing happened. When the curtain fell at the end of the first showing, there were tears in the eyes of people all over that audience. And the critics couldn't figure out exactly what it was in that story that attracted that kind of an emotion. And they finally decided that it was the idealism of the play that did it. And that idealism was articulated in the theme song that Don Quixote sung. Maybe you'll remember some of those words: to dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, and to run where the brave dare not go, to right the unrightable wrong, and to love pure and chaste from afar, to try when your arms are too weary, to reach the unreachable star. This is my quest, to follow that star, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the right without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for that heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest, and the world will be better for this: that one man, scorned, covered with scars, still strove with his last ounce of courage to reach the unreachable stars. Don Quixote sort of reminds us of the way that God sees people. When God looked at Abram, he said, "Your name's going to be Abraham. You're going to be the father of many." That's the meaning of Abraham. "You're going to be the father of many nations." And Abraham would somehow live up to that dream that God had for him. God looked at Jacob, who was a conniving, deceitful scamp, and he said, "Your name's going to be Israel. You're going to be a prince of God." And Jacob began to live up to that dream. Jesus looked at Simon and he said, "Your name's going to be Peter." And sure enough, that fisherman became a rock. You see, it's the power of a dream that we have, or maybe that someone has for us, that often sets life on a very meaningful course. I think that's very close to the power that the Sermon on the Mount has for our lives. It's a seemingly impossible dream. When you look at that words of Jesus, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, and those who mourn, and the meek, and those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, and the merciful, and the pure in heart, and the peacemakers." That's a stretch. And he said, "You are the salt of the earth. You're the light of the world." And he said, "Be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect." That's the impossible dream of Christianity. We can't fully reach it. It's beyond our grasp. But we are better, and the world is better, because it challenges us to try and to grow. And so Matthew comes along and he says that when Jesus preached that sermon, that the people were astonished. They were astonished because it says that he taught them as one having authority. And I have a feeling that they were astonished for at least one other reason, and that is that Jesus would give that kind of teaching and would expect that kind of living from such people as they were and from such people as we are. God made us. He knows all about us. And he gives us a lot of dreams and a lot of ideals, because he knows that we never rise above our ideals in life. The distance between where you are and where you want to be is what keeps you going and growing. And if there isn't a gap between what you are and what you want to be, you're pretty much dead, though you may seem to be alive. You see, one of the most common problems of us as human beings is that we die somewhere around 40. And we're not buried until we're 70 or 80 or more. We live up our dreams too soon. We give up our ideals too soon. And life will never rise above its ideals. But there's another thing about these ideals, and that is that the worth of a dream does not consist in our ability to live up to it perfectly. If it's a high enough ideal, you never will live up to it perfectly. You'll fail to reach it completely. But the worth of an ideal consists in the direction that it gives to your life, whether or not you live up to it perfectly. There will always be a gap between where you are and where you know that you ought to be. It's the direction that it gives to your life that matters. The Hebrew writer over in chapter 11 looked at all of those Old Testament characters and he said, these all died in faith, not having received the promises. But he said they saw them afar off, and they were persuaded of them, and they embraced them, and therefore it says, God is not ashamed to be called their God. God loves the dreamer. David wanted to build a house for God. God said no. Shed too much blood. You're not the one to build a house for the Lord. But he said, when your days are over and you go to be with your ancestors, I'm going to raise up one of your offspring, one of your own sons, and he is the one who's going to build the house for me. And David did not resent that. He accepted that. And he said, my son Solomon, this one that God was talking about, my son Solomon is young, he said, and inexperienced. And the house to be built for the Lord must be exceedingly magnificent. And therefore I'll make preparations for it. And so David did make preparations for the building of that temple. He began stockpiling all of the materials that would be needed for the building of the temple that he wasn't going to get to build. And he died, and Solomon, his son, built that temple. And when he dedicated the temple, he said, my father David had it in his heart to build a temple for the name of the Lord, but the Lord said, no, you're not the one to build this temple. Nevertheless, he said, you did well to have it in your heart to build a temple for my name. If David hadn't had the dream, Solomon wouldn't have had the materials to build the temple. It was the dream that gave direction to David's life, and not the fact that the temple wasn't built until the next generation. That's really the point of the story of Don Quixote. He was an old man, and he saw a prostitute waitress in the inn. And he thought she was a beautiful lady. Her name was Aldonza, but he called her Dulcinea, which means the bright and shining one. She laughed at him. She even spat at him. And everyone joined in the laughter because they knew Aldonza. They knew what she was. But the fact is that Don Quixote saw her for what she could become, not for what she was. And he told her that he was going to be a knight and go out and fight for the right. This was 200 years after the age of the knights. But he said he was going to go out and fight for the right. And he said when he came back from the fight with the spoils, he was going to lay them all at her feet as a gift. And though she laughed at him, he put something in her heart with that dream. When he came home, he was a broken man. He was sick. All his dreams were crushed. He took to his bed to die. Aldonza heard about it. She couldn't bear the thought of his death. She went to his house. She forced her way into his room. And she stood by the side of his bed and she said, "You once called me Dulcinea. Call me Dulcinea again. Bring back the dream of Dulcinea." He seemed to be in a coma. He didn't stir. She knelt by the side of his bed and she began to repeat some of the words of his song to him about dreaming the impossible dream and fighting the unbeatable foe and running where the brave dare not go. And he gradually began to stir. And he struggled to his feet, and he leaned back, and he sang his song, and he collapsed, and he died. They had to pull Aldonza out of the room forcibly, and as they pulled her out, they called her Aldonza, and she jerked loose from them, and she said, "My name is Dulcinea." He'd given her a dream, and she denied it at first and laughed at him, but it made her realize what she could have become and what she still could become. Life consists of our dreams to a large degree. Nations have to have them. Churches have to have them. Individuals have to have them if life is going to be meaningful. You know, when the first settlers came to these shores, that's about all they had. Just a dream. They had a dream where individuals would have the inalienable rights to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. That was the impossible American dream. And it became the only place in the world where a person can start with nothing and become a success in one brief lifetime. We're painfully aware that the nation hasn't always lived up to that dream. We've had our failures and our faults. We do, and we always will. And yet here we are some 16 generations later, grateful to be the recipients of that dream and trying to do our part in it, our little piece of the world, to live up to it and to perpetuate it. Churches have to have dreams. The early church had dreams. They had one very big dream. They were largely without influence. They were without power. Little group. But their leader gave them a dream that was enormous. This little group, he said, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel, and those who believe and are baptized will be saved." And talk about an impossible dream. Go into all the world, this little group. You know what happened? Within 30 years, one generation, the gospel had been preached in all of the then known world. This church has had its part in the fulfillment of that dream in this generation. You've had a very big part in causing the gospel to be heard pretty much all over the world. The largest portion of the budget of this church is dedicated to the fulfillment of that dream, and it has been for many years. Next Sunday, you'll do it all over again. Your missions Sunday contribution, you knock the top off of it every single year, and you will again this time. And it occurs to me that some people may think, and some of you may think, that this is a small church. It's not a small church. It's a very big church. Because you dream big and you give big to make that dream come true. It isn't just the church, of course, that has to have a dream. Individuals have to have a dream. There's an old movie. It was released in 1959. It was called The Five Pennies. And it's really the story of Ernest Loring Nichols, who had a little band back in the late 1920s called Red Nichols and His Five Pennies. That was the day of really big bands. And all he had was a little combo. But he had some pretty good musicians. Gene Krupa, Artie Shaw, Benny Goodman, Tommy Darcy, Jimmy Darcy, Jack Teagarden, Glenn Miller. Every one of those at one time or another sat in that little band. And the thing is, everybody knew them. They were famous. But nobody knew much about Red Nichols, and it was his band. Until this movie came out in 1959. It's an hour and 57 minutes. And it introduced him to us. Danny Kaye played the part of Red Nichols, and in the movie and in real life, one day when Red Nichols was halfway across America traveling with his band, he received word that his little daughter had polio and encephalitis, and there was no hope. She was going to die. He immediately left his band and he went home to San Francisco to be with her. And eventually, the worst of that crisis passed, and the doctor said, well, she may live, but she'll never walk. Red Nichols' life was music, his cornet. He started playing that cornet when he was 4 years old, and he had played it in public since he was five. It was his life. He walked out on a bridge in San Francisco and he dropped that cornet in the water. And that was to serve notice that he had a dream for that little girl and that everything in his life was going to be given to make that dream come true. So he would bathe her arms and her legs with hot towels. He would massage her. He would exercise her, and hardest of all, he would push her. He bought a little puppy for her that she wanted, and he would put it out of her reach. And she would cry and crawl to get to it, and it seemed so cruel. But he thought that he had to push her in order to make that dream come true. That little girl eventually walked again and danced again. Life needs its dreams. I hope you have them. You're what you are today because of your dreams, or maybe because of the dream that somebody else had for you. Maybe it's the dream that God had for you. But if you're willing to lose yourself in a dream that's presently greater than you are, you'll never outlive it. It'll always be a little bit bigger than you are. But the world will be better for this, that one person, scorned and covered with scars, still strove with their last ounce of courage to reach the unreachable star. I hope that one person is you. Let's stand and sing.
I have resolved no longer.